Okay, good morning, everybody. This is about 2:31, Human Anatomy, and it's April 9th. We see the schedule over here on the right-hand side. We're going to talk about the schedule, but first, I want to see if we have any announcements from SI. We have announcement from SI, so here we go.
Hi, good morning, guys. So today is just the regular SI, like usual, for in Business 319 from 12:15 to 1:45, but there's also going to be an additional session on Friday. And it's just going to be a mock exam, about 100 questions and figures, and it's an hour and a half, so kind of see where you're at before. Because I know the test is from Monday, you get back from spring break. So you guys can kind of take that and then study with that during spring break. And that's going to be in Business 311 from 10 to 11:30 a.m. And then the Monday of the exam, there's not going to be any SI, so that session is canceled. So if you guys have any questions, you guys can either email Dr. Gober or my email is also listed on.
Fantastic. Okay, thanks. So an extra session this Friday, April 11th, 10 to 11:30 in BUS 311. Okay, that's really good. So let's take a look at the schedule. What else is happening? Today's the 9th. We're going to get into endocrine system, and endocrine system chapter 17 will be on the test. And that's going to be on a Monday right after spring break. So this is the last lecture before spring break. So the next 2:31 session after this one and lecture is going to be the exam number 3. Chapters 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. All right, so does anybody come to class with any questions? Anybody have any questions we should go over right now? No? Okay, well, let's finish up the sensory chapter. And let's see, can we remember the difference between a general sensation and a special sensation? What's a special sensation? It's defined pretty much by the receptor location and number, right? So special sense, only one location, maybe two. And for instance, what are they? Taste. You can only taste with your tongue. You can hear only with your ears. You can only see with your eyes, right? Can't see with your fingertips. Taste, can't taste with your fingertips, right? What else? Hearing, in your ears, and there's two other senses associated with your ears, and those are what we call equilibrium senses, and there are two. There's something called static equilibrium for linear acceleration and angular acceleration. We call that kinetic equilibrium for angular acceleration. But before we talk about those static equilibrium and kinetic equilibrium, you got to know what acceleration is. Anybody have a clue what acceleration is? What's a good way to think of acceleration? Say, think of your car. How do you relate to acceleration in your car? Could be gas pedal. Could be brake pedal too. We would call that deceleration, but it's acceleration. All right, so the way I think about acceleration in terms of your car is that you have a meter in your car that tells you how fast you're going. What do you call that thing?
Speedometer.
So a speedometer tells you your speed or your velocity, right? And that's not acceleration. Your speed or velocity is just how fast you're going, what kind of distance you're traveling in a certain period of time. But acceleration means some kind of change in that speed, change in velocity. So when you start at 0 miles per hour and you go to 60, we call that acceleration, right? Your speed is changing. That is acceleration. Or if you go from 60 to 0, that's acceleration as well, but that's a deceleration, right? So some change in speed is acceleration. That's what our ears can tell us. In a linear way, but also in a spinning sense. We call that angular acceleration. So not if you're spinning at a constant rate. You have to be changing how you're spinning, either stopping spinning or beginning to spin. That's acceleration. That's angular acceleration. All right, so, but before we get to those equilibrium senses, let's talk about hearing, because actually we're going to talk about a whole bunch of different pieces inside the ear. All right, those three senses. So here is a really nice diagram, illustration of an ear. I'm sure this is an exam figure. And we see that an ear is broken down into three main regions, external, middle, and internal ear. The external ear has the auricle, sometimes we call it a pinna, and that pinna then helps focus sound energy into this external acoustic meatus, and you're kind of familiar with that because we've looked at the skull already. Sound energy enters, and it's still all external ear, and then it bumps up against this membrane, And sound is a pressure wave. It's a mechanical wave that moves through air. And when it bumps up against this tympanic membrane, guess what happens to this tympanic membrane? It vibrates back and forth. Maybe if you have a loudspeaker that has a big driver on it, you can see that loudspeaker vibrating back and forth. Or maybe if you looked at a drum, when somebody beats a drum, this thing beats back and forth. Right, so this is what we call the tympanic membrane. That's the end of the external ear and the beginning of the middle ear. And in the middle ear, of course, we have the tympanic membrane, and we have a number of tiny little bones. And these bones are all within the temporal bone, because remember, that's where the external and the internal acoustic meatus was located, in the temporal bone. These little bones are what we call ossicles, and they carry the vibrations from the tympanic membrane through the middle ear to the inner ear. So here is the inner ear. Sometimes we call that the labyrinth. There is a bony labyrinth that houses some of the organs for the sensations that we're talking about inside the temporal bone. All right, so there's bones inside bones within the temporal bone. The auditory ossicles, right? You see three of them, the stapes. Okay, incus and malleus right here convey the vibrations from the tympanic membrane to a much smaller membrane, which is the entrance to the inner ear. So if we look at the footprint of the stapes right here, what does it look like? Does it look like a square or a triangle or a circle or a snowflake or what? Looks like an oval, and that's how it got its name. So here is the oval window. There's a membrane underneath the stapes that we call the oval window. That's how sound energy enters the inner ear. The inner ear is filled with fluid. And sound energy, all by itself, does not like to enter water. Like, for instance, if you're listening to me and we're at a pool, okay, and we're both standing on the deck of a pool, you might be sitting in a lounge chair, and I'm talking to you about anatomy. You just might decide, well, you know what, I've had enough anatomy, and I'm going to stand up from my lounge chair, and I'm going to dive into the pool, and I'm going to keep my head underwater. And when your head is underwater, can you hear me lecturing to you? You can't, because sound just doesn't have that tendency to get underwater. So this middle part of the ear and the tympanic membrane and oval window right here are arranged so that it amplifies that sound energy so that it can enter the watery environment inside the inner ear right here. So that indeed you can hear things, right, in that watery environment, even though the sound is really out here in the air. And one reason why that works is because the tympanic membrane is really big and the oval window is really small, so that acts like a level of amplification. Small changes, small vibrations in the tympanic membrane produce large deviations in the oval window, so that helps our hearing. All right, but in order for this tympanic membrane to vibrate back and forth, the pressure on either side of it has to be the same. Right, and there's something that will equalize the pressure in the middle ear, and it's called the eustachian tube. Sometimes it's called the auditory tube. Sometimes it's called the pharyngotympanic tube. And this pharyngotympanic tube is just a tube that goes all the way to your throat, right, which is in the back of your mouth, and that just is that atmospheric pressure. Your throat, the scientific name for your throat is pharynx. So that's how this tube got its name, pharyngotympanic. It goes from your throat to your middle ear. And when the pressure is the same, then this membrane can tympanic membrane can vibrate back and forth. But if there is high pressure in this external acoustic meatus and low in the middle ear, then the tympanic membrane gets pushed all the way into the middle ear, and it can't vibrate because it's pushed all the way in. If there's high pressure in the middle ear, it pushes the tympanic membrane all the way out, and of course then it can't vibrate. It's got to be like right in the middle in order for it to vibrate back and forth and transmit that sound energy. Right, you might have had a cold or something at some point where, or maybe you even had an infection of the middle ear. Anybody know what that's called? Very common in kids. What do we call that? Infection of the middle ear. Okay, remember way back in chapter 1, ear was otic, right? So it's called otitis media, infection of the middle ear, which means then a person can't equalize the pressure across the tympanic membrane. When somebody has that infection, then their ear might really hurt really bad when there are pressure changes, right? If they go driving up in the mountains or take an airplane ride or something, somebody with otitis media can't equalize because the pharyngotympanic tube might be so inflamed that it's no longer open, or there might be fluid, or maybe even pus in the middle ear, and then these bones can't vibrate. So when you have a cold, can you hear it normally? If you have a really bad cold, sometimes you have a hard time hearing because there's fluid in the middle ear right here and you just can't hear it very well. All right, so that's something about the middle ear, external ear. Oh, the middle ear also has some muscles attached to these bones. The tensor tympani and a stapedius muscle that connects to these bones so that when you're in a really loud environment, those muscles contract and then they prevent these bones from vibrating or over-vibrating, and that helps protect the inner ear from excessively large sounds. And you're probably aware of that, because have you ever gotten into your car first thing in the morning and you turn your car on and the radio is on, and what does a radio sound like? Have you ever noticed that? When you're just sitting in your driveway or out on the street, turn your car on, listen to the radio, does it sound really, really soft, or does it sound really loud? Usually really loud, right? Because as you're driving down the street, you're listening to the radio and you go, oh, I can't hear it. You turn it up a little bit, right? And then the stapedius muscle contracts a little bit. You can't hear it quite as well. What do? Oh, you turn the volume up a little bit more, right? And then when you get to where you're going, the volume is turned way up and you turn your ignition off, right? And you don't really pay attention to what's going on. And then when you get into your car, the very first thing, right, all those muscles are relaxed. You turn your car on, and what is the volume set at inside your car? Like maximum, right? And you might wonder, oh, wow, it's my wild nephew borrowed my car last night. And indeed, it was just what? It was just you driving home, right? So there are ways to protect your inner ear. Nonetheless, the inner ear can be damaged by excessive noise levels or excessive music levels, sound levels. So here are some of those muscles, the tensor tympani, the stapedius muscle. All right, so now let's focus on this inner ear. Sometimes we call that the labyrinth. It's a bony labyrinth, and there's water inside of there. There's some organs for hearing and equilibrium inside these two different places. This one that looks like a snail, and you see this as being like a snail right here, this is what we call the cochlea. And the sense that the cochlea gives us is hearing. So the cochlea is responsible for hearing. Another part of the bony labyrinth is what we call the vestibule, right, and that's right next to the cochlea. And another part of the bony labyrinth is what we call the semicircular canals. I see two on this illustration, but there are really three. And that's because these semicircular canals will give us the sense of spinning in three dimensions. And we all know that we can characterize our body by three planes. And the planes are, what's this one? Sagittal, coronal, transverse, right? Okay. All right, so that's why we have three semicircular canals. So hearing for the cochlea, linear acceleration or static equilibrium for the vestibule, and angular acceleration or kinetic equilibrium comes from the semicircular canals. So we want to be interested, or we are interested to know exactly how these different structures can convey that information to our brain for us. So which one do you think we want to talk about first? Looks like hearing. Yeah, let's talk about, yeah, we're going to talk about hearing first. All right, so we're going to zoom into this region right here. Where are these things at? Yep. Okay, so we're going to look at primarily the inner ear. This is good. All right, so here is that cochlea. We see some nerves coming out of the bony labyrinth. And you know this to be cranial nerve number 8. It used to be called the auditory nerve because part of it is coming from the cochlea, and everybody knew that was involved in hearing. But of course, it's been simplified to have it make more sense. We don't call it the auditory nerve anymore. What do we call it? You might have to know this for the test. Ooh, it's the vestibulocochlear nerve, because not only does it come from the cochlea, it comes from the vestibular apparatus, so that vestibular cochlear nerve conveys both hearing and equilibrium senses to the brain, because they're combined right there. Okay, so here is that arrangement in the middle ear. You see some of these muscles, right? You see the auditory ossicles. And as a matter of fact, I didn't tell you this before, but I have all the auditory ossicles right between my fingertips right here. And that's why you can't see them, because my fingers are covering them up. Of course, that's a lie. I don't really have them there, but they're so small, you couldn't disagree with it. That's how small they are. All right, so they're really, really tiny. You can see them with your naked eye, but nonetheless, they're pretty small, on the order of millimeters. Okay. So here we see the bony labyrinth removed, and now we see some soft tissue inside the bony labyrinth. We're going to call that the membranous labyrinth. All right, so here is the membranous labyrinth. We call this the cochlear duct. All right, the semicircular canals, the semicircular ducts within the semicircular canals, and the maculae that are inside the vestibule. These are what we consider the membranous labyrinths for these different senses. Okay. Well, let's look at the cochlea, and let's make a cut right through the cochlea. We said, oh, here is the oval window on the vestibule. And what's the function of that oval window? What's happening right there? It's like a doorway. That's a hint. A doorway for what? Sound entering the cochlea, enters the oval window, and sound that goes around the cochlea, and it can't get stuck inside the cochlea because then it would break something. Have you ever seen a commercial where somebody's singing and the glass starts to vibrate and all of a sudden the glass fractures when the sound pressure increases so much? Right, so that sound energy can be damaging. When it enters the cochlea, there's got to be like a relief valve or a relief passageway so the sound can exit. And it does through another window down below the oval window that we call the round window. And if you look in lab, you're going to see that the shape of that one is round. Okay, so that's how sound leaves. So sound enters the oval window, leaves via the round window. All right, so let's cut into the cochlea, and it's going to look like this. All right, so here are some chambers that wind around inside the cochlea. And this right here, right in the center of these three chambers, this is the chamber for hearing. This is what allows us to hear. And this is what we call the cochlear duct. These other chambers are chambers that bring sound into the cochlea, and the other one takes sound out. So one is the scala tympani, the other is the scala vestibuli, and I don't think they're labeled on this diagram, but I want you to see where these different chambers are before I show you the next picture. So here's the organ for hearing, and attached to that is a nerve, right? So this is taking hearing information to your auditory cortex, and I think we mentioned the auditory cortex when we looked at the brain is in your temporal lobe. Okay, so these nerves are connected to your temporal lobe. All right. Okay, so this top one right here, scala vestibuli, it contains a fluid that we call perilymph, and the scala vestibuli is connected to the oval window, so sound enters the cochlea via the scala vestibuli, and then it might move across the cochlear duct into the scala tympani, and it has perilymph as well, and scala tympani is connected to the round window, and so that's how sound energy leaves the cochlea. And as that sound energy moves from the vestibuli into the tympani, right, it's got to move through the cochlear duct, and when it does, it vibrates some things within the cochlear duct. That's the organ for hearing. So I want to zoom in particular into this region right here that's in this little rectangle. And so here we are, right? So as sound is moving from the vestibuli into the tympani duct, then this membrane, which we call the tectorial membrane, is going to vibrate. And we see that there are some things that are connected to the tectorial membrane. And it is some cilia, we call these stereocilia, from these receptor cells. And since these stereocilia reminded somebody of hair, these things are called hair cells. Right. And the stereocilia are such to where when they start to bend, they change the electrical properties of the hair cells, which then change the electrical properties of this nerve so that it sends electrical impulses to the brain. So when the tectorial membrane is not vibrating, then these cells don't have any reason to send a signal to the brain. And what do you hear? Nothing, right? It's not sending the signal to the brain. Okay. So this right here is what we call the organ of Corti. Organ of Corti contains hair cells, so when the stereocilia bend, that sends electrical information to the brain. Okay, here we can see some hair cells. All right, so this is a pretty good overview of what's happening. So here is the cochlea, but what have we done to the cochlea? It's not all wound up, right? We have kind of unwound it, right? The very tip of the cochlea is what we call the helicotrema. Here we can see the entrance right next to the oval window. Here's the exit of sound at the round window. So sound enters, right? And it's going to pass across the cochlear duct and excite the organ of Corti. And I want you to think of the cochlea as being a particular instrument that we're all probably familiar with, right? So let's straighten this cochlea out completely. And it just so happens that this region that's very close to the oval window likes to vibrate at high frequencies. The other end near the helicotrema likes to vibrate at low frequencies. And the organ of Corti that's right in the middle likes to vibrate at frequencies in between. Sometimes we call those mid-range frequencies. So what kind of instrument are you familiar with that if you excite it on one end, it plays high frequencies, and if you excite it at the other end, it plays low notes or low frequencies? When I say frequency, think of a tone or a note. And if you hit it like right in the middle, you're going to hear some mid-range frequencies. What kind of instrument can you think of that does that? Guitar. Yeah, because on one end of the neck of the guitar plays, for instance, high frequencies, and on the opposite side plays low frequencies. And why is that so? Can you picture that guitar? What's the difference between those strings that are on opposite sides of the guitar neck? Are they exactly the same? No, one is what? One is really thin and the other's thick, or one is thick and the other is really, really thin. So the thin wire can vibrate at a high frequency, right? And the thick wire, because it is more massive, will vibrate at a lower frequency. That's just a property of how things vibrate. Large things vibrate slowly. Small, thin things vibrate very quickly. So the same thing with the cochlea, where the cochlea is thickest, which is out here by the helicotrema. This is where it likes to vibrate with a low frequency, and this is the thinnest part over here near the oval window, so it vibrates at a rapid frequency or a high pitch. All right, so besides the guitar, what other kind of instrument might you think of that works like this? Yeah, other string instruments like a violin or cello does, but there's another instrument that has many, many more strings in it. Still has strings, and it's kind of horizontal like this.
Piano.
Ah, piano, exactly what I was thinking of, right? And if you look inside the piano, the strings that make a really high note are what? Really short, and they're really thin. And the strings that make a really low frequency are what? They're long, and they're really thick. And if you look at the piano, you can see it kind of looks like a harp, right? There's some really short, some really long strings. All right, so this cochlea, I really would like for you to think about as a piano, right? And that's exactly how it's working. But we don't really strike these things to make a sound. They just vibrate when a frequency enters this inner ear and they start to vibrate. And then you have those cells that can pick up that vibration and send the information to the brain. What was the name of those cells within the organ of Corti that can sense vibration when the organ of Corti starts to vibrate? They're called hair cells, yeah, because of the stereocilia. When they bend, they change the electrical properties of that cell. All right, so now we can begin to understand why the cochlea looks like a snail. Why does it look like a snail? Because if it didn't look like a snail, you would have like these two pianos sticking outside your head, right? You'd have one on the right, one on the left. And so evolution has figured out a way to take that big long piano, roll it up so that it fits inside just the inner ear. And the arrangement of those nerves go to the temporal lobe, and in the temporal lobe, then you have something that looks like a piano as well. If we stimulate one end of the temporal lobe, you're going to hear high frequencies. If we stimulate cells on the other end of the auditory cortex, you're going to perceive lower notes, right? And if somewhere in between, then you're going to hear like mid-range frequencies. So maybe think of a piano when you look at a cochlea, and that sensory cortex is outlined exactly like that as well. Okay, now on this diagram, it sort of doesn't look like the helicotrema is thicker compared to this area by the oval window, but that's because we're looking from a superior to inferior direction. But if we look down at the cochlea, we're going to see that indeed Indeed, the thickest part is over here. Okay, the widest part, and we can't tell by this diagram, but this is the widest part, this is the thinnest part. So the widest part will vibrate with low frequencies. Okay, so that's pretty much how hearing works. Right, so sound will move from the vestibuli into the tympani based on the shape of the organ of Corti. So this sound I see going across the organ of Corti right in this location. Would this be a high frequency or a really low frequency or mid-range frequency? Mid-range, because it's kind of in the middle. I see one out over here. What kind of frequency is this? This is a really low frequency, and then high frequencies would go across over here. Okay. All right, so that's pretty much it for hearing. All right, so what do you have to know? You got to know, what's the name of the bony labyrinth for hearing? And I see it on this slide, but it's not labeled, thank goodness. It's the cochlea. Yeah, cochlea. What's the name of the membranous labyrinth inside the cochlea that allows us to hear? That's the cochlear duct. Yeah. And what's the organ inside the cochlear duct that allows us to hear? Okay. That's the receptor cell. I'm almost there. But the organ is the organ of Corti. Yeah, organ of Corti. And the organ of Corti is made up of receptor cells, which are hair cells. That's right. And those hair cells are connected to that tectorial membrane that vibrates back and forth when sound enters. All right, so that's a lot of good detail for hearing. And that's in the inner ear. Now, what other parts of the ear do you need to be operating in order to hear something? What are some other parts of an ear besides the inner ear? What else do we have? What else do we have? I don't want to, it's about 10 slides back, so I don't want to go back and show you, but maybe I will. What are the other parts? Ah, I heard auditory ossicles. Where are they located? Middle ear. Auditory ossicles in the middle ear? All right, so middle ear is necessary. If that's not functioning, you won't be able to hear stuff. What's the last part of the ear? The outer ear. Do you need an outer ear to hear? Huh? I can't hear you. Okay, I got my fingers in my outer ear, so I can't. Yes, obviously, we need our outer ear, we need the middle ear, and we need the inner ear to be functioning. And in terms of that inner ear, right, as far as that inner ear is concerned, what do we need? Well, we need an organ of Corti that has the proper structure, right, to vibrate, but we also need to have a proper nerve that is attached to it, right? So there's a neuronal part, and then there's a mechanical part to hearing as well. And if somebody is deaf, it could be due to damage to a nerve, right, or the organ, or even to some of those mechanical things like a tympanic membrane or oval window or auditory ossicles. If we want to help somebody that is losing their hearing or is deaf, we got to be aware of that. All right, so that takes us to equilibrium, the sense of equilibrium. And again, that is in the inner ear. And let's just talk about the vestibule, which is right here. There are two organs that are very, very similar. And so here is a macula, and here's a macula. The organ in this one over here is called the utricle, and then here is the saccule. These are the organs for linear acceleration. So we can sense a change in speed. And it just so happens that gravity works like acceleration on our body. Right? That's just kind of a physical process. So, for instance, when you're standing on the ground, what do you feel? Do you feel the earth around your arms or your hands or your legs? Where do you feel the earth? Gravity, because gravity is pulling on you. It's accelerating. What part of your body feels the earth pulling on you? That is your feet. I feel my feet. The earth, gravity is pulling you down, accelerating you into the earth, right? So we can feel it on our feet. But now let's just say we're sitting in a car and we got our back up against the seat and we're not moving, right? And then all of a sudden we start to accelerate. What happens to the sensation on our back? Do we feel that acceleration on our back? Yeah, it's very similar to what? The sensation that we have on the bottom of our feet when we're standing up, right? So that was just one way for me to maybe try to tell you that gravity is an acceleration, right? When you accelerate in the car, your back feels it, right? When you decelerate, what happens to the pressure on your back? it goes away, right? So that's acceleration. Gravity does the same thing. And the organs that allow you to experience that linear acceleration is in the vestibule right here, and they're called the maculae. One is a utricle, the other is a saccule. All right, so how on earth can that possibly work? Well, here is an epithelium, and we have some neurons that poke up into the epithelium, and they connect to a cell that has these stereocilia on them. And when you look underneath the microscope, these stereocilia look like, what do they look like? They look like little hairs. And so, guess what we call these receptor cells? Hair cells, just like for the sense of hearing. And you might be kind of astounded by that because your sense of equilibrium doesn't feel or seem like the sense of hearing at all. But what about the receptor cell? Almost exactly the same. All right, but how is this receptor cell connected up to the utricle? It's actually a part of the utricle and saccule so that we get that sense of acceleration. Well, the stereocilia, or the hairs, poke up into a gelatinous mass. So here is something that is a little bit stiffer than vitreous humor. You look at vitreous humor from the eye in lab today. So it's like a gelatin material, and so it's bendable, and it changes shape when acceleration is applied to it. Okay, so it can sag. Plus, inside this gelatin-like material, there are crystals. So you have crystals inside your ear that act as little weights, and these things are made out of calcium carbonate. They're called otoliths. Remember, otic has to do with, anytime you hear that, hearing. Right? So these things are in your ear. And gravity pulls down on these otoliths, and when it does, it's going to bend these stereocilia, which then changes the electrical property of the hair cell and changes the electrical signals that go to the brain. Especially in the sense, right? So right now, these otoliths are pushing straight down on the stereocilia. And let's just pretend that we have our head just upright. And this otolithic membrane is horizontal. But now let's bend our head forward like this. Okay? And so now this otolithic membrane, instead of being horizontal, is now vertical. And guess what happens? Gravity is going to pull on these otoliths. It's going to pull on this membrane. It's going to pull it down. And that's going to bend the stereocilia. And that's going to change the electrical properties of the hair cell. All right, so here we see somebody bending their head forward, right? And this gelatinous mass starts to sag down in this direction because the otoliths are pulling it down that way. That bends the stereocilia, and then that sends information to the brain that we're being accelerated in that particular direction. All right, so we have two of these kinds of organs, one oriented in a horizontal plane, one oriented in a vertical plane, and because of that, we have a really good sense of body position, right? And so you can tell with your eyes closed whether you're lying down or standing up, right, because of that sense of linear acceleration or static equilibrium. And that's in the vestibule, right? So the bony labyrinth is the vestibule. The receptor cells are hair cells. So there's a lot of similarities compared to hearing. All right, so that's for linear acceleration. So cochlea for hearing, vestibule for linear acceleration, and then we have these three semicircular canals. And there's an endolymph, there's a fluid inside the semicircular canals, and because it's a semicircle like this that's connected up, that fluid can flow around in a circle. Right, it can flow from one end to the other and it can flow back around again. At the base of a semicircular canal, there's a bulge, and we call that an ampule. Kind of reminded somebody of a little glass vial that we put medication in sometimes. And if you want to get that medication out, you just snap off the glass top, right, and put a little syringe in there and suck the medication out. So that's an ampule. So here's an ampule of a semicircular canal. It doesn't contain medicine. It contains the crista ampullaris. That is the organ for angular acceleration. So let's zoom into this region right here. And so here is the crista ampullaris within the ampule of a semicircular canal. And there's fluid inside that semicircular canal. And here is an epithelium that's lining the semicircular canal. And within the epithelium, within the ampule, look what we have. we got some more hair cells in there, right? And we don't really want to call these hairs. You could, but they are what? Stereocilia, special kinds of cilia. And when they bend, they change the electrical properties of the hair cell, which then sends different kinds of electrical signals to the brain. And this has to do with changes in the amount that you are spinning in these three dimensions. Hence, we call this angular acceleration. So just like for static equilibrium, there's a gelatinous mass. We call that the cupula. And it can bend back and forth because there are certain times this endolymph will push on this gelatinous mass. And when a gelatinous mass gets pushed one way or the other, it bends the stereocilia, which then sends those signals to the brain. So how on earth can this possibly work? Why do these things bend around? Well, first I want you to think of this endolymph, okay? And it has mass, and mass has a property of inertia. And fortunately, there's been a commercial plane for quite a while now that kind of makes fun of this physical property, okay? And does anybody know what a property of inertia is? It has to do with mass. The commercial says a body in motion likes to stay in motion, and a body at rest likes to stay at rest. Okay, so that's really the property, the physical property of inertia. So when this endolymph is stationary and you start to move, what can you tell me about the endolymph? It likes to stay stationary. It likes to stay where it is. Okay, so when you start to spin, this crista ampullaris, since it's attached to your body, it starts to move, but what about the endolymph? It doesn't like to stay, so since you're moving and the endolymph is not moving, it's going to push on the cupula, and it's going to bend these stereocilia right here, changing the electrical signals going to the brain. All right, so if you're standing still and you start to spin, the endolymph is still kind of stationary, and it's going to push up against the hair cells. Right, and that's an acceleration when you change the amount that you're spinning. All right, and I'll describe the next part of this, and probably you did this over the weekend. Okay, so we started to spin, and we're going to spin for a long period of time. And when we spin for a long period of time, guess what happens to this endolymph? It starts to spin, and it catches up with your body, right? Because it's not going to sit there forever. You have those forces acting on it. So you've spun now for a minute, and then all of a sudden you stop, okay? And the crista ampullaris stops, but what about this endolymph right here? It's still spinning inside that semicircular canal, and you look out at the world, and what do you see? You see the world spinning because that endolymph is pushing in the opposite direction on the cupula, and you get that sense of deceleration of spinning the other way. And then if you stand there for long enough, then the endolymph stops spinning and then everything looks normal once again. Okay, so that's just that property of inertia of endolymph and how it can push on one side or the other of the cupula. All right, there's just a nice micrograph of what the crista ampullaris looks like. Oh, and here is just a slide showing what we just described. So if you're just standing still for a long period of time, endolymph is not moving, crista ampullaris is not moving, hair cells are pointing straight up. When you start to spin, the crista ampullaris is spinning with you, but the endolymph is not, so it's going to flow over the cupula and bend the hair cells. If you spin for a long period of time, the endolymph catches up with your body, so that when all of a sudden you stop, right, crista ampullaris stops, but now the endolymph is going to push back the other way until it catches up to your body, it's going to stop flowing, right? And so you get a sense of acceleration and deceleration, but not in a linear sense, but in what? A spinning sense. So you can tell that you're going to be, because you have three semicircular canals, you can tell if you're spinning in any of those three planes. And if you're spinning at an oblique angle, some combination of those planes, then your brain can figure out exactly what angle you're spinning at based on information from those three semicircular canals. All right, so that is kinetic equilibrium. All right, so what is strange about what we looked at? What's the receptor cell for hearing? The receptor cell for static equilibrium? The receptor cell for angular acceleration? Hair cell? Are you kidding me? You're not kidding me. And you're right. It's always a hair cell. It's going to be a hair cell. Yes. because of those stereocilia. It's not like they have hair growing out of them. They're specialized cilia. Okay. So that is the two senses for balance and one for hearing within the inner ear. All right. Deafness. Oh, I did mention this, but I want to go over it once again. There are two kinds of deafnesses or two reasons why somebody might be deaf. One is called conduction deafness, and the other is called sensory neuro. Right? Conduction deafness is when there's damage to the outer ear or middle ear, so sound can't move across the middle ear into the cochlea, so sound doesn't get transmitted or conducted from the ear into the cochlea. Right? So that could be due to a ruptured eardrum, otitis media, or maybe there is sclerosis of the auditory ossicles. All right, but the organ for hearing is undamaged. The nerve is undamaged. Right, so if we can bypass the problem or repair the problem in the eardrum, then hearing can be restored. The other kind is what we call sensory neuro, and that means that there's damage to the organ of Corti, or maybe there's damage to the auditory nerve or vestibulocochlear nerve. Maybe the inner ear is absolutely perfect, but the organ of Corti is damaged, right? And when that happens, then there has to be other kinds of remedies, for instance, like a cochlear implant. If the organ of Corti is damaged, then there has to be a little microphone placed in somebody, and that microphone then connected directly up to the auditory nerve to help them hear. Now, they won't hear exactly like what they're used to hearing, but they'll hear some sounds, and then they have to retrain their mind and their brain to interpret what those sounds really mean. And some people can do that, other people can't, and I don't think anybody has a really good idea why some people respond to that and others have a really hard time. Maybe it would help if you speak many languages, right? Maybe a cochlear implant would be beneficial. And if you're not that familiar with language, maybe you speak one language, maybe you speak poorly, and then a cochlear implant might not help you as much as some other person that deals with more complexity in language sounds, for instance. All right, so those are two kinds of deafnesses. All right, so which one of these, static equilibrium or kinetic equilibrium, has to do with angular acceleration? Angular acceleration is what we call the sense of kinetic equilibrium. And linear acceleration is static equilibrium. And we call that static equilibrium, and because gravity, even though we're standing still, gravity acts like acceleration on our body. Okay, and kinetic has to do with spinning or angular acceleration. All right, so that's it for the sensory chapter. When I go back to vision, how many kinds of photoreceptor cells you have by shape in your retina? Two. Did we go over that? There are two. What are those two cells? Rods and cones. Yeah. What good are rods? Okay. What's the advantage of having rod cells? They work in dim light. Rod cells work in dim light. Okay. What's a disadvantage of a rod cell? They work in dim light. That's good, but what's not such a good thing about them? They're not for color, they're for black and white only, right? And because they're big, they don't give you a lot of fine detail, right? So they kind of give you a blurry image. A cone cell, on the other hand, what's the advantage of a cone cell? You can see color with them, and since they're small, you see fine detail, but what's the disadvantage of that since the cell is really small? You need really bright light in order for them to work. All right, so you got bright light vision, which is good and colorful. You got dim light vision, which is coarse and only in black and white. All right, and they're located in different parts of the retina. In your central vision, where your best vision is, you have mostly cone cells. In your peripheral vision, where your vision is not so good, you have rod cells. But it's relatively good or bad. Right? It's bad in the sense of color, but good in the sense that rod cells work in the dark or much darker conditions. Okay, so that's it for this particular chapter. So I'm going to put these things away and move into endocrine system. Well, fortunately, we have We have talked about the nervous system. And there are some similarities between the nervous system and endocrine system in that the nervous system is in your body to control different areas of your body, for instance, with your brain. Your brain can help control skeletal muscles in your hand, which are really far away from your brain. Right? And nervous system works very fast. So if I want to move my hand, then nerve impulses reach my hand very quickly, and I have really good control, very fast response in my hand. And if I want to stop my hand from moving, again, I can withdraw that stimulus very, very quickly. So nervous system operates very fast over long distances. The endocrine system can operate over long distances, but it takes longer to have an effect. And once the effect happens, it takes longer for it to disappear. So it's not fast like the nervous system. It's longer duration, but it's slower in onset. So the endocrine system is made up of endocrine glands. All right, so here we have an illustration with some endocrine glands. And you should contrast this with another kind of gland that we've talked about. And I think that was in the first chapter, second chapter, it was in the tissue chapter. You had to learn the name of some glands by their particular shape. Okay, so you have endocrine glands, and what's another kind of gland? Exocrine. Yeah, and so you should know the difference. An exocrine gland has what? It has ducts. So a gland produces a product, secretes that product outside the cell. If it's an exocrine gland, that product gets into a duct, and the duct carries it to where it's going to have its action. Like, for instance, digestive enzymes made in the pancreas are secreted into a duct, and the duct carries it to the small intestine where they start to digest things. You wouldn't want to release digestive enzymes in the pancreas because what would happen to the pancreas? It would get digested. That's terrible when that happens. And it does happen. It's called pancreatitis. That's really nasty. Pancreatic cancer, same thing. Really terrible things when your pancreas starts to auto-digest itself. All right, so there's exocrine. Endocrine glands don't have a duct. And an endocrine gland produces a product, secretes it, and that product then travels to different parts of your body. Okay, and how does that product get to different parts of your body if it doesn't have a duct? I don't think we talked about this. But those products get absorbed by the circulatory system, your blood vessels, and once it's in your blood vessels, where does it go? Everywhere that blood goes, which is most places in your body, right? So an endocrine gland doesn't need a duct because it uses your vascular system or your blood. It has to be delivered. Okay. So an endocrine gland, the product that it secretes is called a hormone. So a good definition of a hormone kind of goes the opposite way. A hormone is produced by an endocrine gland, right, where it enters the blood, travels to a distant location in your body, and it has to bind to a receptor at that distant location, and when it binds to a receptor, it changes the physiology of that cell. It produces a specific response in that particular cell. All right, so the other thing that's nice to think about is, does one hormone affect all the cells in your body? It can't affect all the cells in your body. It will only affect a few kinds of cells. And why is that? Because in order for a cell to be able to sense that hormone passing by, it has to have a receptor for it, right? And the hormone has to bind to that receptor. If a tissue or a cell has a receptor for a particular hormone, we call it a target cell or target tissue. So in order to be a target tissue, what do you have to have? A receptor. You got to have a receptor for some kind of hormone, for instance. All right, so I like this little blurb right here. Right? A hormone is a compound secreted by an endocrine gland, ductless gland, directly into the circulatory system where it travels to a distant target tissue and elicits a specific response. We're not going to talk about specific responses too much in this class, but physiology, we love that kind of stuff. But what's loaded in this term is target tissue. Travels to a target tissue. But what, you know what that means now. What is a target tissue? It has a receptor to a hormone, right? That's what that means. All right, so what are some of the functions of the endocrine system? Well, it regulates relatively slow processes like growth, metabolism, reproductive system, right? Some blood chemistry, immune response, things that don't happen very rapidly in your body but are more long term. It's more important to control these things over the long term. So on this illustration here, we see a list of some endocrine glands. So do these endocrine glands have ducts?
No.
They do not. Okay. We have some endocrine glands in the brain, like the pineal gland. The hypothalamus secretes hormones. The pituitary gland secretes hormones. Right, so we got to consider these things endocrine glands. But the hypothalamus, right, since it secretes a hormone, it's an endocrine gland, but where is it located? It's in the brain, so it's made up of neurons. All right, so that's kind of confusing, because what do you know that a neuron usually secretes? What does a neuron secrete? A neurotransmitter. Well, here now we have some neurons that are secreting a compound, right? Do we want to call it a neurotransmitter or a hormone?
Neurohormone.
It's actually both, right? So we want to call these things neurohormones. So the hypothalamus is, that's right, because we talked about autonomic nervous system. So the hypothalamus is another area where the endocrine system and nervous system come together, function together. They act like what? The neuroendocrine system because of that hypothalamus. All right, some other glands, a thyroid gland, thymus gland, the adrenal medulla and adrenal cortex, gonad, all right? And what are the two classes of gonads that we have in this room? We have testes, which is, it says right here, and ovaries, right? These are both what we call gonads, right? Depending on your particular sex. All right, so here are some. But there are many other kinds of endocrine glands in our body. For instance, like the heart is an endocrine gland. That might be surprising to some people. All right, digestive tract secretes hormones. Kidneys secrete hormones, or at least that's on this diagram right here. And the skin is also an endocrine gland because it produces hormones and secretes them. And we might get to talk about some of these things. All right, but in physiology, we cover them a lot. So you might just kind of have to take a physiology class one of these days. Okay. Most glands, most endocrine glands are epithelial in origin, right? And because we know what an epithelium covers the surface, lines the cavity, or makes glands. But we just talked about one that's not from epithelium, and that is the hypothalamus. So there are some exceptions, but mostly they come from epithelium, but there can be others that come from nervous tissue, right? And even muscle tissue, for instance, like the heart, and even some connective tissues like in the skin. Okay. All right, different classes of hormones. Some can be made from amino acids, right? And what do you know? What is an amino acid a building block of?
Protein.
Yeah, protein. So some hormones kind of look like proteins. Some are really small. Like, for instance, insulin is a very, very small. We call that a peptide. And some look more like lipids, and those are steroid molecules derived from cholesterol. So a good example of a steroid hormone, right? One from the testes would be testosterone. One from an ovary, actually ovary produces two, estrogen and progesterone. Males don't produce anything like progesterone, but they produce something similar to estrogen, and that is testosterone. And in order for your body to make testosterone, estrogen, and progesterone, what molecule does it need as a precursor molecule? It says on this slide right here. It is? Where is it? Cholesterol. So is cholesterol a good or bad thing in your body?
Good and bad.
Yeah, it's good and bad. You got to have some to make sex steroids, right? And it's bad if you have too much because it can produce vascular disease, cardiovascular disease, right? No one would ever not want to have some cholesterol because then you wouldn't have any sexual function as a result of that. Okay, how are some of these things? How are these hormones controlled? How are they released? They're secreted maybe in three different ways that we can characterize: humoral, neural, or hormonal. Humoral just means that there is some chemical in the body that's triggering its release. If it's neural, then there is a neuron triggering the release of a hormone. If it's hormonal, then an endocrine gland is releasing a hormone because it's being told to by another hormone that's coming from another endocrine gland. Right? And here's a pretty good slide that shows all of that. Okay, you got humoral, you got neural, and we got hormonal stimulus. Oh, what does a stimulus always produce? a response, right? So for a humoral stimulus, for instance, like calcium in the blood, that's a chemical in the blood, is going to be monitored by the parathyroid glands, and depending on calcium concentration in the blood, parathyroid glands will secrete parathyroid hormone, okay? And parathyroid hormone partially can go to bones and cause bones to dissolve to increase blood calcium levels. All right, so that sounds like a terrible thing, but what else do you need calcium for in your blood?
Muscle
contraction, synaptic transmission, right? And you probably all would rather have that than strong bones, for instance, when you run low on calcium. So calcium is the chemical that elicits the response from this particular gland, so that's humoral. Neural stimulation. We looked at this before. Here's a cell body in the lateral horn, right? That's in the thoracolumbar region, so this would be a sympathetic outflow pathway going to the adrenal medulla. When electrical impulses reach the adrenal medulla, these cells then are stimulated to release epinephrine and norepinephrine. All right, so that's a neural stimulus. That's different than humoral. And then there are some endocrine glands, right, that aren't stimulated electrically or due to chemicals. They are stimulated directly by hormones coming from other endocrine glands. A really good example of this is the interaction between the hypothalamus and this anterior part of the pituitary gland. The hypothalamus secretes a hormone, gets picked up by the blood, delivered directly to the anterior pituitary, which then goes, so these hormones, for instance, one is going to be called thyroid stimulating hormone, which goes to the thyroid gland and is going to cause the thyroid gland to secrete thyroid hormone. All right, so here are a couple of cases. Right, there is a releasing factor from the hypothalamus affecting endocrine glands in the anterior pituitary, which release a hormone, which then goes to even a third endocrine gland to cause it to secrete its particular hormone, like thyroid hormone from the thyroid gland. Maybe a mineralocorticoid like aldosterone from the adrenal cortex, and even sex steroids from the ovaries and testes, okay, are going to be released due to hormones released from the anterior pituitary. These are all really good examples of hormonal regulation or stimulus. Okay. All right. So what's next? Let's start talking about some of these glands, like pituitary gland. We're kind of familiar with pituitary gland because we've done central nervous system already. So, of course, here is the cerebral cortex, nice corpus callosum, third ventricle. Here's thalamus. Here is hypothalamus. And then right below the hypothalamus is the pituitary. And you see it nicely cradled within the sphenoid bone. And you probably know what this depression in the sphenoid bone is called. That's the sella turcica. Don't know if that was on the practicum. Probably should have been, because it's really important. Because it holds the pituitary gland. Okay, so here's pituitary gland. And when we look at the pituitary gland, does it look homogeneous? Does it look like one gland? Does it look like one gland? I see two. I see one color here and I see another color over there, right? So the pituitary gland is kind of complex. So there's an anterior part and a posterior part. One is made from epithelium, the other is made from neuronal tissue. Can you tell by looking at this diagram which one is from neuronal tissue, the posterior or the anterior part? From neuronal tissue, it is the posterior part. I'm hoping that this posterior part of the pituitary is the same color as the brain. Is it? Close. Okay, kind of close. Okay, so therefore it is. All right. And the other way you can tell is that here's the hypothalamus and here's a connection, right, between the hypothalamus and the pituitary, and somebody should know what this little connection is called. Okay, don't tell me the really cute name that I used in lab today, but what's the real scientific name for this? This is the infundibulum, or you could call it the pituitary stalk. And there are tracts that go from, okay, the hypothalamus into the posterior pituitary. So those tracts carry nerve impulses to the posterior pituitary. When those nerve impulses reach the posterior pituitary, those cells release hormones into the blood, sort of like the adrenal medulla. But the anterior pituitary responds to hormones that are released by the hypothalamus. And so those hormones have to go by a blood vessel from the hypothalamus into the pituitary gland. So there's two different ways that the pituitary gland can work, depending whether it's anterior or posterior pituitary. All right, let's see what other kind of nice slides we have. Oh, yeah, I see the nice pituitary stalk right here. Another name for pituitary is called the hypophysis. All right. Okay, so a hypophysis. We can see the posterior pituitary, anterior pituitary. Let's see, what do I want you to know about this kind of complicated slide? Well, in lab, you got to know mammillary body. Infundibulum, I want you to know, and I want you to know posterior and anterior pituitary. I don't think I want you to know all these different subdivisions of, for instance, the anterior pituitary. It's okay if you know that the posterior is called the pars nervosa because it is nervous tissue. Right? So that's maybe not a bad thing to know. But these others, the distalis, intermedia, tuberalis, is not so important for this particular class that you have to know that. Okay. Let's look at control for the anterior pituitary. There are neurons in the hypothalamus which receive information from your brain, which gets information from all over your body, right? And it makes decisions on how to control various aspects of your endocrine system. And it has axons that reach right to the base of the infundibulum, and then they stop. When a nerve impulse comes down this track, instead of releasing a neurotransmitter, it releases a neurohormone that gets picked up by this capillary, right? And a capillary is the only kind of blood vessel where things can enter and leave the blood system because they're really, really thin. So these hormones get picked up by this capillary bed. It moves through a blood vessel through the infundibulum, and it goes to another capillary bed in the anterior pituitary. And since it's a capillary, what happens to those neurohormones? They can leave, right? They can move down their concentration gradient through these capillaries, and then they can bind to receptors in the anterior pituitary. And here are some hormones that the anterior pituitary produces. Thyroid stimulating hormone, right, which goes to the thyroid gland. Follicle stimulating hormone. This goes to an ovary to help produce follicles, which then will produce an egg. Luteinizing hormone. Luteinizing hormone in the female will go to an ovary and cause ovulation, right? The spitting out of an egg from a mature follicle. Right, both of these right here, since they go to an ovary or a testes, all right, we call these gonadotropins, because what's a gonad? Ovary or testes, right? And a tropin is something that stimulates or promotes growth of a particular tissue, and this particular tissue is a gonad. So these are gonadotropins. Both FSH and LH are gonadotropins, have a little bit different action on a gonad. ACTH stands for adrenal corticotropic hormones. These go to the adrenal cortex, not the adrenal medulla, but the adrenal cortex. And it maintains the adrenal cortex and helps secrete some hormones from the cortex. Growth hormone goes everywhere. And prolactin. Where does prolactin go? Or what's the target tissue for prolactin? What's lactation? Yeah, so there are receptors in the glandular tissues of breast, right, that respond to prolactin. So when prolactin binds to those receptors, then the glandular tissues of the breast start to grow and proliferate. What's a typical time for a female when that happens? During gestation, right? When you're pregnant. Okay. So prolactin doesn't produce the milk letdown reflex. It doesn't eject milk from the breast. It just grows the glandular tissue so that it can produce milk. Right? So that's the deal with prolactin. Okay, so all of these are from the anterior pituitary, and they're controlled by hormones from the hypothalamus. All right, so how is this possible? These hormones from the hypothalamus are what we call releasing factors or releasing hormones. So the hypothalamus will stimulate the release of thyroid-stimulating hormone by releasing a compound called, let's see if I can write this, good enough, I think, I hope. All right, so TSH is going to be released by the anterior pituitary. The hormone from the hypothalamus that's going to cause release of TSH is called TSH-RH, releasing hormone. So that's not too bad. What's another one that we have right here? ACTH, right? ACTH comes from the anterior pituitary. What causes the release of ACTH? We're going to say ACTH, what? Dash RH from the hypothalamus. What about prolactin? PRL. What causes the anterior pituitary to release prolactin? Do you sort of get the drift of what's happening here? It's going to be PRL, what? RH. So these are from the hypothalamus, and these are from the anterior pituitary. All right, so each of these anterior pituitary hormones have their own releasing factors, and sometimes there are inhibitory factors that are released as well. And that probably isn't a big shock to you, because in order to have precise control and balance over important function, what should you have? You should have antagonistic control, right? So some factors are excitatory, some are inhibitory, but that's probably not so important for you to appreciate the very specific names. All right. Well, right now I got to talk a little bit about the vascular anatomy. And you're going to see this theme carried out in a number of places in the body. So here we have a blood vessel bringing blood to an organ. A blood vessel bringing blood to an organ is an artery. And it's nicely colored red right here. Right? So here is an artery. I don't think I want you to know the name of the artery. But here is a capillary. Right? Artery feeds blood to a capillary. This is the one that picks up a hormone. Right? And then this capillary condenses into a couple little blood vessels right here that take it to another blood vessel. This is highly unusual. This is what we call a portal blood vessel. Usually there's only one capillary from when blood leaves the heart to where it returns back to the heart. There's usually only one capillary. But in the pituitary gland, there are two, and this is a special delivery system. It specifically picks up releasing factors from the hypothalamus and delivers them directly where? To the anterior pituitary. So it's a door-to-door delivery system. These hormones don't get diluted in the whole circulation. They're just carried to the anterior pituitary directly via this portal blood vessel. And since it's in the pituitary, we call this the hypophyseal portal vein. Hypophyseal portal, because hypophysis is another name for pituitary. All right, so that's how hormones are carried to the anterior pituitary. These are the hormones released from the anterior pituitary. And what do we have over here? Anterior lobe hormones. Their names, right, and what their target tissue is, and what the effect of that target tissue is, or on that particular target tissue. Like, for instance, gonadotropins, there are two, FSH and LH. And here are those names, and their effect is a little bit different in males and females, but pretty similar. FSH causes production of sperm in the male, helps development of an egg in a female. A little bit different, but pretty similar. LH helps males produce testosterone, okay, and in the female, it helps produce estrogen and progesterone, but also ovulation. And males don't have anything like ovulation, right? So that's not characterized right here. All right, so here are the list of anterior pituitary hormones, right, including prolactin. This is how it's controlled, right, from the anterior lobe. And then we need to talk a little bit about the posterior lobe. Okay, posterior lobe right here, the pars nervosa, is neuronal tissue. So there are not hormones that leave the hypothalamus that move into this region. There are nerve impulses that go through the infundibulum. And when that nerve impulse reaches a tissue in the posterior pituitary, it releases a hormone, right? Which means what? It goes into the blood. And the posterior pituitary is a little bit simpler because there are only two hormones released from the posterior pituitary, and they are antidiuretic hormone and oxytocin. And we see that on this slide. All right, so here are some nuclei in the hypothalamus. What's a nucleus again? Group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. They're not myelinated, so these are gray areas in the hypothalamus or a nucleus. And there are two different nuclei responsible for synthesizing these two different hormones, namely what, oxytocin and antidiuretic hormone. And so there's a capillary in the posterior pituitary. When these neurons release oxytocin and antidiuretic hormone, then they go directly into the blood to affect target tissues all over the place. All right, so what does oxytocin do? What's the target tissue for oxytocin? It is smooth muscle. Oxytocin is a powerful stimulant of smooth muscle. It causes contraction of smooth muscle. Maybe not every smooth muscle, but many, many, many all over the body. In particular, a really good example of this would be uterus, right? Uterus is in pelvic cavity. So is the uterus a skeletal muscle or smooth muscle? Do you have voluntary control or involuntary control of uterus? Involuntary control, it is smooth muscle, right? It's not skeletal, not attached to skeleton. It's in a body cavity. Oxytocin causes contraction of the uterus. So guess what hormone increases during parturition? Oxytocin from the posterior pituitary gland, right? So oxytocin causes delivery, and maybe you've known somebody that had a delay in delivery and they were given a hormone to induce delivery, and guess what that hormone was, or what that substance was? It was oxytocin, okay? Okay, and there's some other forms of oxytocin. But basically it was oxytocin. Oxytocin also goes to smooth muscle of the breast, causes contraction of smooth muscle of the breast, and if it's been prepared with prolactin, if that breast is producing milk and then smooth muscle contracts, guess what happens to that milk? It gets squeezed out of the breast. We call that milk letdown reflex. So oxytocin is important for those two reasons. Other reasons too, for contraction of the uterus and milk letdown reflex. One last thing I want to cover before we go. Antidiuretic hormone. What does a diuretic do? What does a diuretic do? Diuretic makes you pee. Yeah, it just makes you pee. That's what a diuretic does. An antidiuretic does what? Helps you retain water, right? It stops you from making urine, and so you retain water. So when you're dehydrated, antidiuretic hormone is really important because it helps you conserve water when you're running low on water. So that's the purpose of antidiuretic hormone. So in your body, you should have what? You should have diuretic type hormones and antidiuretic hormones that mix together so that you have proper control of water balance in your body. Okay. Well, these other things I'm going to have to put online for you, like thyroid gland. Some of these things we've talked about already. Just a couple more things, and maybe I'll go over that pituitary gland online. All right, so make sure you can play videos from the practicum. All right, make sure you can download them and use a VLC player or a DVX media player, unless you know how to get your Windows media player working. Okay. Study guide I did load in. I loaded those in this morning. For endocrine system. Okay, question. That was your question. It should be right at, I just copied, and so it's going to be appended. It's going to be right at the bottom of the study guides. Right smack at the bottom. Yeah, I'll try to move it up so it's in the proper position, but right now it's just in there right at the very, very bottom. And don't forget sign in sheet, please. Whoa.
I signed the one of the same last
time. Oh, okay. It'll cost you $20. Okay, thanks for letting me know. Yeah.